Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, all you wiretappers. It's good to be here, back here in the Ice House, the classic old Ice House in Midtown Kansas City, and just up the street from several different mob hits. We like being in the middle of the action. We like hearing stories from the mouths of the men who did it, whether they be policemen or crooks, like our good friend Craig Glazier, the King of Sting. I'll never forget that night. That was a heck of a story. I'm here with my good friend Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Who else have we had on that was out of the men, mouths of the men who did it? Red Womet. I'm going to do another show with him. I've been Facebooking with him recently.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of mouths of men that did it, we, of course, have great interviews with Tommy Robinson and Joe Langer talking about
Richard Grissom Jr.
Or the four-part series where we spoke with Troy Cole, the chief investigating officer, sergeant of the homicide squad from the Kansas City Police Department for the Bob Berdella case.
Right, and Gunner Allen Lindblom, who was a Detroit mobster, did 13 years in penitentiary, and only less than 6 months after he got out, he has gotten a book published that he wrote while he was in. He wrote several books while he was in the penitentiary. He was connected to the Tocco family, the kind of the ruling family of the Detroit mob. He was half Sicilian himself. It's the name of his book is To Be a King. Who else have we had on here? We had the flying skyjacking DB Cooper copycat, our good friend Martin J. McNally. Martin, where are you? Are you in London? Last we heard, he was flying off to London to had some kind of a movie deal in the works, I think.
Had signed his non-disclosure agreement, so he couldn't really tell us.
He wouldn't give me any details. He just said that he was trying to get a passport and he was going to London. Who else have we had? We've had, Red Womet. I mentioned him. He's got a book. What if...
Former retired FBI agent.
Bill Owsley.
Bill Owsley.
And he's got a book, Mobsters in Our Midst, and Open City. It's got two books, and Open City. I'm going to meet him for breakfast next week. Actually, one of our fans got hold of me and wanted an autographed copy of his book. And so I called Bill, and he said he needed to come into the city anyhow, and he'd bring me an autographed copy, and I'd mail it out to our fan. Now, if any of you guys want some of these books personally autographed, you don't know that people have been on our show and you don't know how to get hold of them, get hold of me and through the Facebook, Gangland Wire, or the Twitter, at Jinx Law or at Gangland Wire, or through my website or ganglandwire@gmail.com, and I will make sure you get an autographed copy. Talking about fans out there, and we get some exchange from fans. We're using some of you guys who will, if you will call my cell phone and leave a message and say your name and where you're from and that, and tell people that they're listening to Gangland Wire, why, I'll let you open the show. I'll put that little piece in. I've got a few of them I've been putting in. I don't have near enough. Just call 816-931-3535. When the answering machine comes on, why, record that little bit. Say, my name is Gary Jenkins, and I listen to Gangland Wire. I love this podcast, or something like that.
And say where you're from, maybe.
I might want to say where you're from.
I mean, that would always help if you're like, my name is Aaron, I'm from Kansas City, and I love Gangland Wire.
There you go. That would be even better. I know, like, Scott from Dallas or Fort Worth, he said, my name's Scott from Fort Worth, and I'm listening to Gangland Wire. So, yeah, just something simple like that would be great, and you can help participate in the show. I think it makes it more fan-friendly, and that's what we want to be. We want to have some interaction with the fans. You know, if we put something up on Facebook, you know, make some comments once in a while or ask them other questions. You may have a question about Mad Sam, and I've done, you know, there'll be more research that I've done, for example, on the Mad Sam story, that if you ask a question, then I'll interact with you and answer your question on Facebook. I put all these up on my Gangland Wire Facebook page, links to the podcast.
And every once in a while, when somebody sends a comment, Gary forwards it to me.
Yeah, and this is one I forgot to forward to you because, well, actually, I didn't take time because it just came in. This was, you remember we did the story on Mr. Saeed, who killed his two daughters. They were like honor killings here in the United States, killed him down in Texas. He'd been a taxi cab driver, and I can't remember all his first name. We'll just call his Mr. Saeed. Well, I'm going to read this to you. Sometimes it gets a little scary. I'm not going to give I got the email. I'm not going to give out the email, but let me read this to you. The radicalized Christian extremists are using this propaganda to make money for the church. They mostly use the uneducated fat rednecks that don't know anything except for drinking beer, getting laid, and throwing parties. Is that a religion? Singing in church? I don't think so. The church runs $1 billion industry to make Muslims look bad in America. How sick is that? They said the Saeed sisters were dating Americans, but they don't want to know the damn truth that they were Mexicans. Filth that came out of the slums of Mexico. Two beautiful girls going out with these two Mexican murderers that killed Mr. Saeed and his two daughters January 1st, 2008, New Year's Eve. Well, January 1st, New Year's Day. And these guys are running loose in our cities, targeting other families. The Christian mentality is sick, very sick.
So they're saying that these Mexican guys that the girls were dating, the daughters were dating, actually killed the daughters and the dad.
And the dad.
That's why they can't find him?
Right. But they left the daughters there, but they spirited the dad's body off, I guess. You know, sometimes logic and rational thought does not enter into people when they want to make some kind of a political statement or prejudicial comment, and they get caught up in what they think is some plot against, I guess this would be against... Islam or
Muslims,
I guess.
Making Muslims look bad. And it certainly didn't make them look good, but if you've got a comment or you can post it on the actual blog page as a comment that everybody can see.
Right.
Or you can email ganglandwire@gmail.com and maybe we'll read it on the air. What we're really looking for, though, is some good information.
Exactly.
What we really want is to get that reward, and hopefully Mr. Saeed is out there and alive, and somebody's got some information, and then he gets caught.
And they'll get the $100,000 reward, and they'll give us 20%, 10%. I don't know. I think 20%. And she wouldn't have known about it except
each.
For us. Ten each. There
ten
you go. Each. 10 grand each. That'll be good.
I mean, that's not a lot. Here, Gary had forwarded me an email here this morning from a Russian fan, who writes, "Hello, my name is Miroslav. I want to thank you for the good and the quality of the program. I'm with my family, always listening to you with great pleasure. I would very much like to receive your gifts with your logo. It would be the most expensive things for me. Is it possible? ? I wish you happiness and prosperity. Your fan."
Right, and
Miroslav,
I'm going to get a hold of you. I know I've already emailed you back and said it's really prohibitively expensive to mail anything. Even when you make a donation, then by the time I pay for the mailing and the product that I've had made as a award or reward for making a donation, it ends up costing me more money. And you know, we operate on a shoestring around there anyhow. But since you were nice enough to get hold of me and let us know how much you like the show, I'll get you some kind of a digital award of some kind. I got a couple of things in mind that I think you'll enjoy.
You got a few things up that's on the site right now for people
that
do. Make donations.
Right. You just have to. I have to give you the password. You have to give them the password to get to them. But I've got them somewhere else, and I can just attach it to an email. So I'm going to take care of you. We always take care of our fans. To a greater or lesser extent, but we can't operate at a net loss. We already are putting out a lot of time and money for the studio and the Freedom of Information Act request. And And the donations are we've gotten some donations, but, you know, we aren't quite at the break-even point yet, and we bring you a lot of free content. So we...
Well, I even looked it up. I was kind of curious. Well, how, I mean, it is expensive to ship things overseas, but in this person, this fan is in the Ukraine, and the least expensive was like $32.95.
Right.
For and then the next level, there was only two levels, $32.95 and like $64.95.
What about the and then there was how much they weighed?
Yeah, that was based in part on weight, and then you had to have a declared value, which means you might actually have to pay some sort of a, I guess, you know, like a import tax.
Yeah, I had a guy up in Canada that was interviewed me when I first did my movie, and he said, "Oh, send me." I said, "You want me to send you a copy of the movie?" And he said, "Well, yeah, send me a copy." And of course, the interview was over by then, and I went to look, and this is several years ago when I'd first just put out a lot of money to pay for getting that movie done, pay my cameraman and my sound man and a bunch of other things. And
Voice guy,
the narrator, and I'd put out a lot of money, and I didn't know if I was ever going to get any of it back. And I looked, and to send one DVD just to Canada, it was going to be, I think, $28.50 or something like that. I just didn't send it. I'm sorry, whatever your name was up there in Canada, that was part of some kind of a internet radio show. But I just couldn't bring myself to do it then. I could now probably if he'd, you know, help promote my movie. But
well, now you could just send him, not that you would send him the $28 worth of shipping.
I could just send him a link
to
watch
streaming.
You'd
send him a link to the streamed version.
Right.
Which doesn't have all the great outtakes.
No, it doesn't have the what do you call that? Not the B-roll.
Bonus features.
Bonus features. Yeah. I got about, what, three or four bonus features on there. That one, that interview of Commander Clifford from Kent Clifford from Las Vegas Police Intelligence. That's a classic, man. That you got to get that movie, folks, and see that interview, the special features of the Las Vegas Police Intelligence Unit commander during the late 1970s, and something he did when he felt his officers were being threatened by the Chicago mobsters. This guy. He's like a real deal cowboy out of the old West.
Yeah, don't give it away.
I'm not giving it away.
Because you can't
gotta buy
it
to see it.
Yeah, you can't actually see it if you get it on Amazon as a rental or purchase. But if you
get hold of me and I send you a copy, it's got the special features on it.
If you're in the United States, $25 donation.
Right. That. Yeah, $20 if you just want to buy the movie. $25 donation, and I'll send it to you. Aaron, tonight it's just kind of an interesting little story. It's a mafia story. We have an interview with our friend David Amoroso of GangstersInc.com, who is a organized crime blog site, website, and he also has a Facebook page, Gangsters Inc., and he has a lot of good information, and he told us about the Italian mafia in the United States and how they moved into Europe in Amsterdam and England and opened casinos, a little bit about some English mobsters, the Cray twins. And it just got me to thinking, this is on his Gangsters, Inc., about Dutch criminals. They have criminals over in the Netherlands. I thought everybody rode bicycles and ran windmills and
wore wooden shoes
and skated with Hans Brinker on the canals whenever they froze over in the winter. But you know, in modern times, they now run internet cafes in which you can buy hashish and marijuana and smoke it in there. And they have red light districts with prostitutes standing around. Beautiful Russian girls is what a friend of mine that's been over there told me. Standing in the windows that you can rent for a couple hours and all kinds of vice activities. And
I mean, that beats putting your finger in a dike.
Yeah, really.
I mean, to hold back the ocean.
You're killing me over here, Aaron. You're killing me.
I was waiting for that one, too, talking about the Dutch.
And I did not set him up on that one. I hadn't, my mind hadn't gone there, but Aaron did.
Yeah, I was going to say, I blame Hans Christian Andersen.
Hans Christian Andersen, it's his fault. Hans Brinker and his silver skates. The largest art heist in history, one of the most famous, and probably who's the man whose paintings are worth the most, and mainly it's just because he got hot, he got popular, is Vincent van Gogh. Cut off his ear over a woman, supposedly. Probably had some kind of epilepsy or some kind of mental and emotional problems that caused him to see things a little bit differently, which they claim that's why Starry, Starry Night, the one painting where he paints the stars, is done in the manner that it is. And the olive grove trees, it's another famous painting, and the olive trees are this real impressionistic kind of way he painted this. They don't look like a photograph of olive trees, of course, or... But his paintings are worth millions and millions of dollars, and there's a special Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam. In 2002, a man named Octave Oki Durham, his moniker, his nickname was Oki, and his partner, Hink Beeslijn, B-I-E-S-L-I-J-N, Beeslijn, came up with a plan to steal some Van Gogh paintings at the Van Gogh. There's a really famous, well-known Van Gogh museum that has nothing but Van Goghs in it, of course, in Amsterdam. These guys cased the place for quite a while and figured out kind of the scheme of things. And all they used, they had, you would think that they would have fancy equipment to cut out the alarm. They would have to lower themselves from the ceiling and you know, like Tom Cruise would maybe do some kind of gyrations to avoid any kind of laser beams that would, if they were broken, would set off an alarm. All they had was a ladder. They stole a ladder. They had some rope and a hammer. And they entered this museum, and they grabbed Vincent van Gogh's View of the Sea at Scheveningen and congregation leaving the Reformed Church at Nguyen. While they stole the paintings, they figured out the police response. They had a scanner that was monitoring the Dutch police frequencies so they could monitor their movements. Well, they set off the alarm, but the cops are on their way, and it takes a while for cops to get there. You know, once you call 911, they don't just appear immediately. Once you set off an alarm, that's got to go to the alarm company, and then they have to kind of test it and see, well, make sure this isn't a false...
false alarm.
False alarm, yeah, false technical set off of the alarm, or wasn't some kind of an animal that was walking through there that set off a motion detector. The wind just shook a window and set it off, and they kind of checked that before they call the cops. And so by the time they called the cops, they were monitoring the police frequencies, and they realized the cops were arriving pretty quickly out in front. And that's where the ladder was, out in the front of the museum, where they crawled up and went in a window. So they had a rope, and they were on the second floor, and they just went out the back of the museum, slid down the rope, and got away in a stolen car they had out there. Now, they made one mistake. They left a baseball cap. It fell off of this guy, Octave Durham's, fell off of his head and had his DNA on it. And I guess his DNA was in a database because they were on to him right away. But for some reason, I don't know, these Dutch police are not real aggressive. What I read was, because there was a lack of urgency in the case, the police did not search Oki's residence or any other location where he was known to keep the paintings, and he had moved them to his residence, and it gave him more than enough time to get him away to a safe location. He actually went to a friend of his house who was a... over there they have football, and you guys who are listening in Europe and in England or Russia, our Russian friend, you know that it's called football, what we call soccer, and the professional teams are called FCs or football clubs. And so FC Barcelona striker Patrick Kluivert actually let Oki and his partner stay in his house while he was on the run from the police. They kind of looked at this. I think this was all over the news, and everybody kind of looked at it as kind of a romantic sort of a crime, I believe. Nobody got hurt. It's kind of like something you would, you know, Aaron, think about it. It's like you see a movie about these master criminals, and they steal multi-million dollar paintings, which are really of no value because Who's going to buy one? You can't show it to anybody. The minute one of these two paintings hits the market or is viewed by anybody that knows anything about a Vincent van Gogh painting, they know it's stolen. Anybody that's in the know in that world knows that these paintings and know they were stolen. So in a way, they have no value unless you find that weird collector that just wants to have them in his vault and go in and look at him himself that you read about or see in books or see in the movies.
I don't know. The first thing I'd do is get out of the country.
Well,
I mean, it's Europe. It's pretty easy to travel between the different, you know, countries. Not that Interpol couldn't find you, but to hang out in the same city seems to make it easy.
Yeah, it did. And they hung out there for a while, and I think they tried. He was not a master criminal. First thing he tried to do was sell these paintings to someone in the Amsterdam underworld, which our friend David Amoroso told us about. There is an underworld. There is like a master, you know, criminal gangs and people in charge of things and other people in the criminal underworld in Amsterdam. And what they learned, here's what I thought. Well, one reason I wanted to tell this story is these mobsters saw it as a bargaining chip they could use in court in the future. Now, he started out, there's a Dutch drug boss, Cor van Hout, who was really eager to buy the paintings because he thought he could use it because he had a court case pending. He ended up being shot in some kind of a hit from some other crime he was involved in before they could actually come together and do a deal. There's another Dutch crime boss named Mink Kok, K-O-K, who was living in Beirut, Lebanon, and he offered to buy the Van Goghs, but they didn't get that done. Oki or Mr. Durham, the kind of the mastermind of the two criminals, Mr. Hink and Oki, had a contact from somebody called Pinocchio, who was an important player in the Amsterdam underworld. He owned a coffee shop called the Coffee Shop Rockland, where they sold marijuana, a place that tourists could come in and smoke hash and marijuana. And who that actually was an Italian drug boss who was linked up with what they call the Neapolitan Camorra. His nickname was Raphael Imperiale. So he had like these three different identities and different names. The street name was Pinocchio, but he was a member of the Neapolitan Camorra. Now, the Camorra we have in Sicily, which is the far south, we have the La Cosa Nostra, or the Sicilian Mafia. But in other areas of Italy, we have different mafia.
I was going to say, I had not heard the term Neapolitan Camorra, but I'm assuming it wasn't an ice cream.
No, it was not. The Camorra is not an ice cream. I got a little information on it, Hill. It's a crime syndicate or a secret society. It's not Neapolitan. My son is Scott's favorite type of ice cream is a Neapolitan. I never really liked it myself. It's the kind Grandma Jenkins always had, and I wanted chocolate chip. It always seemed kind of bland to me. But they are totally different from the Sicilian Mafia and from Naples, which is much farther north in Italy. One way they're different is they don't have a real pyramidal structure. You know, the Sicilian Mafia, we talk about that all the time. You've got a boss, you've got an underboss, and you've got capos or captains, and you've got members, soldiers, soldatos, and you've got associates. They are more, more horizontal than vertical. In other words, everybody kind of acts independently for themselves. You know, I may have a little crime organization. You may have one. Somebody else may have one. And they're more prone to feuding among themselves is for sure. They don't go back as far as the Sicilian Mafia. They only go back to, around the early 1400s. They're kind of a descendant of a Spanish secret society, the Garduna, which was founded in 1417. The criminal gangs in Naples formed these early groups. They had, for example, secret hand signals, and particularly when they were gambling, and they would expose certain amounts of fingers in order to cheat other people at gambling games. This activity was prohibited. And then pretty soon they started paying off the passing police whenever they'd be engaged in a gambling game and have some fish out there that they were fleecing, using their little hand signals to win the game. Modern day times, they are more involved in narcotics and in the transportation and of narcotics out of the Mideast, out of Afghanistan. You got all the heroin, the poppies that they grow in Afghanistan, and hash and other marijuana out of Lebanon, and they facilitate the importation and distribution of those particular narcotics out of the Middle East. They probably, in current modern times, they probably get cocaine out of Colombia now because cocaine has gotten so popular. But one of these Camorra Mafia bosses, whose name is, or nickname is, Rafael Imperiale, was involved in importation and distribution of narcotics, and he had caught a case. Well, he bought the paintings from Mr. Durham, and he held on those paintings. This was back in 2002, sometime between 2002 and 2016. We don't know exactly when, but sometime over those years, he bought those paintings, and he held on to them until finally he had a case. And then he offered them to Italian authorities in exchange for lowering the prison sentence he had. He had 20 years in prison for drug trafficking. Now, have you heard of anything like that, Aaron?
No, I haven't heard of that. But I might be able to understand if it was a Van Gogh.
Can you imagine in the United States if they took down a drug dealer and he said, oh, well, yeah, here's what I'll do. I've got these stolen $25 million each paintings that I will trade for a reduction in sentence. Do you think that would happen?
Well, wouldn't they say, well, bring us the paintings and we'll consider it?
They probably would. They probably might trick him, although I don't even know if they'd do that. But they might say, bring me the paintings and we'll consider it. And then they'd say, well, we considered it, and no, you can't. We'll tell the parole people once you go in and start serving your 20 years, and we'll let them know. But I just don't think that they would ever make any kind of a deal like that. But in Italy, they did. And he negotiated an 8-year reduction. He got it down to 12 years. He moved to Dubai in the meantime, and he is a fugitive and never served a day in prison. And they got the paintings back. Now, Durham, he's on the run. He flees to Spain. He runs into his friend Patrick Kluivert. He tells the police he's been hiding with Patrick Kluivert, who is a star player with FC Barcelona, their soccer team, and he's been hiding out with him. But Kluivert alleges that this is nonsense, and he's going to sue Durham for libel. Of course, Durham's got more troubles than any lawsuit for libel. Kluivert's lawyer says Kluivert maybe once met this guy in passing, but never gave him shelter. He was never in his house, and these are extremely defamatory statements which will not remain without consequences. There's a documentary out there if you want to find out more about this case. Look for this documentary called Brandpunt, B-R-A-N-D-P-U-N-T. Will tell you more about this art theft than you ever wanted to know. He's out of jail now, and there's this documentary that's going to be released. He only served 25 months in jail. So it's, I don't know, it's kind of the thing they make movies about, the kind of the romance of the art thief. And
mm-hmm. Here's an interesting thing that I did not know. Dutch law allows stolen work to become the property of the thief after 30 years of its theft.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that either.
Here it says Durham and Hank may have used this loophole to their advantage, served their time, and kept the art hidden for 30 years until they could legally claim it as their own.
Yeah, but then in the meantime, they had sold it to this Italian member of the Camorra Mafia, who then used it as a bargaining chip to bargain down his
own sentence.
His own sentence, because they've been returned to the museum.
I mean, the guy, the Italian guy who was a drug smuggler who had a 20-year sentence reduced by 8 years. These guys stole the two paintings. They only got four each.
Well, doing drugs is selling drugs is not quite as or as a much more,
it's more frowned upon than
frowned upon than stealing art. The man that bought a Mr. Imperiali, his lawyers said that he knew that they were stolen, and he bought them because he was fond of art and they were a good bargain. He sent them to Italy and never displayed them, and never knew any. Nobody knew he had them. He'd had them since, since right after they stole them in 2002. He'd had them all those years, 2002 to 2016. That's 14 years. Those paintings were missing, and when he made the deal, they got him back.
Well, so this is a very recent story, because here on Newser.com is a story that was published on March 20th, 2017, entitled, it says, quote-unquote, Born Burglar Details How He Pulled Off Van Gogh Heist. Octave Durham spills all the details on the 2002 theft in new documentary. Here it says he calls himself, I'm a born burglar, says Octave Durham, per the New York Times. Yeah, but he's a born burglar, but he's not a very good fugitive.
The Van Gogh Museum remains furious at Mr. Durham and would not cooperate with the documentary. And that documentary was funded by the Dutch National Broadcasting Company. You know, it's different over there in Amsterdam and the Netherlands, isn't it?
I'm guessing that after the burglary, they stopped leaving the ladders laying around the museum.
Probably, and they probably, you know, he just broke out a window. They probably hardened up those windows a little bit and maybe put it. They've got that glass that, have you ever seen that glass on, like, those riot scenes? And one of these rioters will try to break out a store window and with a big trash can, and they can't break it, and they just beat it and beat it, and all it'll do is just, it'll shatter. It'll have shatter marks in it, but you can never break clear through it. They need to put those kind of windows in it. You're going to have that kind of painting in the Van Gogh. Who'd thought the Van Gogh Museum would have windows that you could just break with a hammer and crawl in and go get something and not have a good enough alarm and not have any guards on duty at night?
Yeah, Durham, according to this article, says it took him less than 4 minutes to nab him two works of
inestimable. Value, $20 million, probably $20 million each at least, and then some. Now they have even more value because they have this great story that goes with them. Obviously, if you could buy them and put them on your wall, Aaron, you could brag to all your friends. Oh yeah, these are the same two paintings that guy Mr. Durham stole and then sold to a mafia drug lord who then traded for a reduction in his sentence and got them back, and then I bought them. What a provenance, as they say. That's what we should do. We should, like, with modern technology, we could just snag an image off the internet and then make a copy of it.
Blowing it up and making it appear to be as a, you know, a counterfeit.
Right, and then put it in a frame, and then we'll stand out in front of Chubby's and say, hey, psst, you want to buy a stolen painting?
Yeah, you're not going to get much there, though.
No, you don't think I could get a couple million there?
No.
No, okay. Maybe I should walk on farther south down the plaza and stand out in front of...
That's probably more the neighborhood you want to go to.
Stand out in front of the black market white something or one of those other fancy clothing stores down there. I can't even think of the names of any of them now.
The only thing they're going to know Van Gogh is maybe Van Gogh get some drugs up there in Midtown Kansas City.
Van Gogh get me 25 cents and then I can got enough to buy me one of those little plastic bottles of vodka. I always like the story that I just am like $12.50 short of getting a bus pass, and my mother's deathly ill down in Columbia, Missouri. I had somebody pulling my driveway like that once, and I was coming in. It was kind of in the dark. It was 8 or 9 o'clock at night, and this gal pulled in my driveway, and I pulled in behind her or next to her. Actually, it's a double driveway, and I got out. And she jumps out, and she says, Mister, she says, I just need $10 to get enough gas to go visit my father who's sick in, you know, Lawrence or something like that, and I'm almost out of gas. I said, no. Oh, okay. And she just backed out and went on. I never did figure that one out.
Pulled into the next driveway.
Okay, I didn't, you know, she didn't pull in the next driveway, but I bet she didn't go very far and found another driveway that she thought somebody was home and pulled into.
Just anybody that happened to be outside that she could accost.
Yeah, exactly. I think there were some lights on in the house, looked like somebody was home.
Just like, I don't know, 3 days ago, I'm walking into Westport. And I mean, it was still daytime, and there was a younger Caucasian girl, and she's asking for some kind of help, and I just keep walking. I'm like, no,
really?
I can't help you. Sorry, I don't know what it is. I don't know what you need. I can't help you.
I can call 911. Is that what you want?
I don't think she wanted that either.
Yeah, I know. All right, well, that's my story for tonight, and I'm sticking to it. If you have a friend or relative has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I've got to say, folks need to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app for $1.99. You can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And to top it all off, what you need to do is buy the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available on Amazon for rental or purchase. And then on top of that, you've got to get Gary's newest book, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI Wiretaps Ended Mob Domination of Las Vegas Casinos. Available at Amazon or on my website, and I'll send you an autographed copy.
From the mouth of the men that did it.
Exactly. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Good night, Aaron.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.
On the advice of my lawyer, I respectfully refuse to answer that question, as my truthful answer may tend to incriminate me.
Tree.
Tall tree. That was a good one.
Put an R in there somewhere.
A Freudian slip.
That's why, like you see me, I make little notes. I write things down like that. I try to... And sometimes I have to kind of do that pause where I'll go back and look at it and go, okay, I got to make sure I say this right. I'll be interviewing people on my program and I'll do that. And I'll be like, all right, well, he's going to be performing at Musical Heritage Theater.
I see our friend Elliot's going to be performing.
Yeah, we've set up event pages for all those different.
I saw all those. I didn't know who the others were.
I shared the one. I only shared out the one with Elliot.
With Elliot. I thought I saw some others that you created in events.
There's event pages for each of the
I just saw
each
that
of the performances, but I hadn't, Tom had set it up and then we kind of edited it and he added me as admin and that was just the one I shared. I need to go back and share them all, but yeah. Still.
And I saw all the others because it said you created an event. I saw that.
Yeah.
Because I saw all the other events, but I do remember now you had shared the Elliot's.
Yeah, I think because I had added you, you know, like because somebody I was sending it to.
Okay,
it
that's why
part
I got
of why
it.
You saw that one.
Okay.
I didn't send it to a bunch of people, but I just sent it out to a few and just kind of because then I had to go back to the website and. Because I put in a PayPal for the festival pass.
Oh, okay.
And then I had to set up a PayPal for individual event tickets.
Oh, okay. I hadn't really looked into it. I just noticed it. I knew there was plenty of time before it happened.
Not that anybody's bought any of them or anything.
Yeah, well, that's how it goes.
Yeah, I know. That's why I'm...
You've done this before, Aaron.
Well,
so
I know. And Tom is like, you know, we're into this thing for like, you know, it's like $1,600 in comics.
Yeah.
$500 for the venue without talking about paying for any advertising or anything else.
Really?
Tom's like, well, don't worry about it. I've got money. And I'm like, well, if we're splitting it, it's still like, so I'm going to like the 1st of April, I'm going to do like an Indiegogo or not a Kickstarter. And just do that for 30 days. See if we can raise $500 or $600.
Yeah, you, I think you'll be able to get that.
I mean,
you got a lot of friends out there that got $5.
I mean, what I want to do is just turn around and use it like, you know, do the Kickstarter. And then when you make a donation, you get a ticket.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. And maybe sell some tickets in advance
like that, yeah.
You know, of course, the other thing is once you sell an advance ticket and if you have to deliver it to them, there's all that cost. But
do what? I tell you what I
kind
did.
Of be
I,
in
just,
that.
I just held something at the door.
Yeah. You can do a list at the door.
The few people that did our podcast are down there. I just printed off something and had it at the door.
You had like that, because every time they PayPal'd it, then you could print something out.
I could print something off. There was only three or four, but I just printed that off, and you could just print anything off.
I hope there's more than three or four. Man, that would be...
Yeah. Well.
I mean, if we have seven shows, that's not enough.
No, well... You're trying something more ambitious than our podcast thing was. We had nothing out in that in advance to speak of.
Yeah, the room didn't cost us anything for that. Right. It's just our time.
It's mainly our time. I don't think I did even a Facebook promo for it. I don't think I did anything. So
I thought we put up an event page.
An event page, but that didn't cost anything. No. So.
All right.
All right, let's try it.